Dive into Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. This episode is focused on someone who is perhaps not best known for music, but music and some very surprising songs and performances have been part of his career since the start. He's known as a comedian, an actor, and now a fine artist, but he started as a musician. He was also a bona fide pop star for a while, and if you're even vaguely familiar with his TV work, then you'll almost certainly know the oeuvre of folk icons Mulligan and O'Hare, the performances that featured on The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, and Shooting Stars. I'm very happy to welcome to The First Time, Jim Moyer, also known, of course, as Vic Reeves.
And it's you.
In this episode, we talk about Jim's earliest musical loves, which included Bowie, Hendrix, and Dave D. Dozy Beaky McIntitch, and the first gigs he went to, and his early passion for drumming and playing the guitar. We also discuss the more left-field bands that he fell for, like Henry Cow, Captain Beefheart, and King Crimson, and how they influenced his first band, who were called Trout. We also talk about the impact of punk on his life, and of course we'll talk about the first single he ever released, a cover of Born Free, and then there's that massive number one hit with the wonder stuff, Dizzy. We'll return to that later. We'll also find out the dangers of getting your head stuck in a washing machine on Top of the Pops. And if you ever heard the rumour that Jim provided backing vocals for a Morrissey track, we can reveal the truth behind the legend. Plus, we cover his passion for Brian Eno, The Fall, Kraftwerk and Black Midi. But I started by asking Jim, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, my grandma and my auntie Ada lived in Leeds, and they had an old gramophone. So I think the first thing I remember is the Red Red Robin on a single, which was like a multicoloured vinyl. And I seem to remember that that was the song that I wanted on all the time.
How in a red, red robin comes bobbing along, along. There'd be no more sobbing when he starts throbbing his own sweet song.
The rest of what they had was, you know, the old ladies who would say The Sound of Music endlessly, like twice a day for a month. That was them. So if I could prize The Sound of Music off the gramophone, I'd get the Red Red Robin on. And if it wasn't that, I used to really like Oklahoma and South Pacific.
Was it quite a musical household that you grew up in?
Not really. My dad was a big jazz fan, so he liked Stan Kenton and Jacques Lussier and people like that.
Thank you.
my mum had no interest in music and still doesn't.
Doesn't like music.
Yeah.
First music that you bought, what was the first single you bought? Tell me about going and buy it, and what was it?
The first record I bought was by mistake, because I went to the pictures to see 2001 Space Odyssey. So I went to the record shop and wanted the theme tune, but I came back with Space Oddity by David Bowie. It had only just been released, so I came home very despondent. I put it on and I went, what is this? This is what I've went in to buy. And then within seconds, I was the coolest kid in school.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom.
I grew to like it and then became a Bowie fan. So I did it by mistake. I got cool by mistake.
Did music kind of feel like a precious thing to you? You know, there's that idea of putting the record on and kind of entering that world, and other people just kind of put it on. It's just a thing they have around.
Well, that was the first record. Then the first one that I bought with my own money and got it right was Voodoo Child.
Nice.
By Hendrix, which I've still got, and I think it says 6 shillings on the cover. But I heard that when we went to Butlins. I persuaded my mum and dad to take us to Butlins in Filey for a holiday, and they used to play music over the tannoy all the time everywhere, and that was on there, and I thought, I've never heard anything like this. This is insane. But I loved it. I used to have an old tape recorder, a reel-to-reel, and I used to tape Annie Nightingale off the radio at night, because I used to listen to late-night radio. And somewhere there are tapes of me talking about the music over the top of it. And then recording Top of the Pops and things like that, you know. So there's a lot of stuff on old reel-to-reels.
And what was the first gig that you went to?
Near where we lived, there was a rugby club, and they used to have Do's on there, and they'd put a great big marquee up. So I think me and my mate crept into the tent and saw the Tremolos.
That's kind of cool.
Well, kind of. I don't think it was ultra cool, but it was pretty groovy at the time. But before that, I saw Dave D, Dozy Beaky, Mick and Titch in the pantomime. Zabadak, and he had a whip with him. Did the whip on the stage, which I thought was cool. Yeah, my mum was going, oh, that pop group were very loud, weren't they? Far too loud.
Music's something that's run throughout your life and your career. Has it always been that kind of fascination for those, whip or not, those kind of the rock star, the person on stage singing, captivating the audience? Has that always been...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I did like what everyone else did. I had a walking stick and I posed around in front of the mirror using my walking stick as a microphone. I did plenty of the posing. From listening to late night radio, I got into odd and strange stuff quite early on. I was like a very early fan of Captain Beefheart.
Yeah.
When I was very young. I think Trout Mask Replica is still one of my favourite albums, but it did take me about 15 goes to actually get it.
And Henry Cow is someone that you've mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I really like Henry Cow because maybe I was influenced by my dad and his kind of avant-garde jazz thing, and I like classical as well. So I still love Henry Cow. I think they were great, and I don't know how you describe it. It's sort of jazzy, classical, film music. It's I don't think it can actually be pinpointed and classified, really. That's another thing that takes a lot of lessons before you get it. I don't think I know anyone else who actually likes Henry. Oh, actually, I know two people who like Henry Cow, but there's not many around.
It's kind of that Bonzo's thing, isn't it? It's that kind of like, just chuck it all in and see what happens, but with a certain amount of virtuosity going on at the same time.
Well, they did a lot of improvisational stuff as well, which is okay, but I like the actual written stuff. It's very complicated. If you get something that's really complicated and spend some time with it, you're going to come out trumps. You're going to come out on top, and you're going to get more benefit in the long run.
But you've got to put the hours in.
You've got to do the work, yeah.
Tell me about your first band.
I'll start off with the instruments I got. I got a drum kit from Exchange and Mart, and I was only allowed to play in the garage on Saturdays. So I took the snare drum into my bedroom and practiced me rolls and then waited for Saturday before I could let rip. There was too much tension. I was waiting for Saturday too long. So I swapped it with a friend of mine who had a guitar, and I ended up just playing it like a bass. I just used the top four strings, tuned it to a bass, and started playing along with records on a guitar that was tuned like a bass. So we got a group together, and this was about the time the Bay City Rollers were around, and we were playing stuff that sounded like Hawkwind. In my friend Robin's front room, there's three of us. There's me on bass, guitar and drums. So we were just doing these long, hour-long which didn't really vary from that. And then looked out the window and there was about 15 girls in basically roller outfits. And I don't think they minded what the music was or what we looked like or anything. It was just like, there's music coming out that house, so we're all going to stand outside. So we got all these basically roller fans listening to us doing Hawkwind. After that, I got into a proper band. We were a three-piece. And the guitarist, he really liked Bowie. So we did some Bowie songs. And I really liked King Crimson. So we did some King Crimson.
Always easy for a young, inexperienced band. Play some King Crimson. That'll be easy.
Well, it was. It was all very stop-start. What they call math rock now, I think.
Yes, they do.
We won competitions. We did gigs all around the sort of North Yorkshire, Durham area. And we did really well. We were good. And we had a residency every Friday just about in a pub in Darlington. So we did good. And then punk came along and that dissolved us and got rid of all those clever little riffs and just started playing really, really basic punk rock stuff.
What was that band called, I should ask?
Trout.
Kraut.
Trout.
Oh, just Trout.
Just Trout, yeah, although Kraut sounds good.
When punk hit, did you have your sort of epiphany, as so many musicians and artists say that they have when they suddenly realise that the rules didn't apply anymore?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was great because it hit me right just at the right time. So let's say in 1977, I was 18. So I could go and see The Clash and The Slits and everyone. All, you know, every week we'd go and see some new band. Saw everyone virtually.
What's The Clash like?
Just like you'd expect. They were great early Clash. They just did, you know, White Riot. I remember we used to go to a cafe called The Golden Egg and someone came in and said, "Have you heard this?" And it was White Riot and, you know, that was it. It just sort of kicked it all off for us. So we'd go and see The Clash. Favorite ones, I think, probably in Victoria Park at the Rock Against Racism.
Oh, you went to that? Awesome.
Yeah, that was great. I sat in a tree and watched most of it, and then I got on the back of Steel Pulse's lorry because they were playing on the back of a wagon, so I jumped on the back of that.
So at what point does the sort of story split between, well, there's music and there's, you know, starting to study art, and there's also the sort of performance in the sort of theatrical comedy world? How does that sort of triumvirate kind of happen?
Well, in my bedroom, when I was listening to me Hendrix and me Roxy music and punk records, I'd be painting all the time because there's no distractions from screens in those days other than your TV. So you made your own entertainment. So I'd just be painting all the time. I'd draw whilst listening to music. So that's where that love came from. And as far as performance goes, I think I got the, you know, I noticed when I was in a band that lots of girls were hanging around, which is that old cliche, isn't it? But it's true. But I just like doing it. Actually, there's a funny story. When I was in Trouts and we used to play at the Bowes Wine Cellar. It was a very long, narrow pub and I had my bass in my hands. And when people came through the door, they'd have to walk straight past me. So I developed a style where I'd have to lift my bass up in the air to let people past. So I've got this kind of like groovy style going on. You know, you do things in front of people. If people like it, you kind of get a kick out of it. You know, you're making your own music and people are liking it. So what's not to like about it? That started me off on things stage-wise.
Yeah. But I was doing a bit of digging online and I found Fantan Tittlespan.
Well, that was... we all moved to London in 1979 from Darlington and there was Wasp synthesizers and those little four-track recorders. So you can make your own music. It was all in a little package before laptops or anything. You could just do it on this machine. So that was us making music. And actually, I was in quite a few bands and we used to change our name all the time just to be annoying, I suppose. People couldn't follow us because we thought it was kind of punky to like be in a band and no one knew who you were or what you were called. I was in a band once and we said, let's just not have a name at all. And we have some flasks with curry in and let the waft of curry drift around. It'll be the band who smell like curry, but I don't actually have a name. But then we found that you can't actually advertise it because you have to put something on a poster.
What other memorable bands from that era stick in your mind?
The Fall.
There we go. Fall. Right.
When did you fall for The Fall, Jim?
Probably listening to John Peel. And then I don't know why I went to see him first, but I'm still a huge Fall fan. Yeah, it'd be Dragnet Live at the Witch Trials very early on. First two or three albums were good, but they got better after that, I thought. I mean, I like the music. I like Mark Smith's words. I mean, I suppose that's what it is. That's the root of it is words, which would be, I could listen to all day. And you always find something new if you can penetrate his voice. I mean, I listen to things now and think, oh, that's what he's saying there. And I first heard it 45 years ago.
Time.
Did you ever meet him?
He was a friend, yeah.
Right. Tell me about that. What was he like as a buddy?
He's a lot nicer than you would expect. You know, if you see him in an interview, he's quite derogatory about people, and he would be about me. But if you go out with him, he's just a lovely bloke. The last time I saw him, we were in Manchester, and he took us to this pub. It was a very rough pub with a really rough upstairs. And he said, "This is why I always wanted the Fall to play in here." He said, "But no one would have it." I'm thinking, well, I'm not surprised. It was a proper dive. And then we went outside into this beer garden so he could smoke his fags. And it was pouring down with rain. So he just sat and says, "It's all right, got an umbrella." We just sat under this umbrella. And I took some really good photographs of him because I just got a new camera that day. I took some pictures of him, which are really quite dark and miserable.
I don't know if this is true or not. In 1990, Jim provided backing vocals for Morrissey. Is that true?
Yeah. Morrissey invited us to go to, is it Hook Manor? They were recording there. And he was doing That's Entertainment. And he said, "Do you want to do the backing vocals?" So I went, "Yeah, all right, yeah, I'll go in." So I just got in and did it. That was it. I think I'm still on there.
Yes, that's entertainment. That's entertainment. Two lovers kiss among the screams of midnight. Two lovers miss the tranquility of solitude. Read graffiti off slash seat of fez. Splattered walls and the kick in the balls is all that you get in the name of entertainment.
That sounds like a very casual list of events to do something quite special.
We'd just done the big night out. He was a fan, so he invited us over. And, you know, we went and did some recording. Then it was very formal. We had a nice vegetarian dinner and he had a glass of red wine. And the rest of the band, I think it was mainly a lot of people from Madness. And so he went off to bed. And then it kicked off. Then the party started. I remember they put me in this room that he says, "You're sleeping in here." And then the letter said, "You know, that's the haunted room." But I'd enjoyed myself with Madness far too much to spot any ghosts in the middle of the night.
Your first single under the name Vic Reeves was Born Free. Right?
Yeah.
It's quite a respectful version. I assume people were expecting something more surreal or whatever, but it's done quite straight, isn't it?
Well, the music was done by Swing Out Sister.
Right.
They did the music. And I turned up on, I had an old 1950s Norton. So I rode across town on my Norton. It had clip-on handlebars, so it was really quite unpleasant to ride through the middle of London. So I went there, did it. I said, "Look, I really want to get home. Let's do this in one." I think I did it in one take. I said, "That's good enough. I'm off now." I think at that time I was really into John Barry. And I wanted it to be sort of John Barry-esque, but a bit more modern. And that's what came out of it.
When you were asked to do kind of a whole album, was there that little sort of teenage bit of you going like, "Oh, yes, okay, now it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was about 30 and I thought, well, pop stardom's passed me by. I'm on the telly now doing some comedy, but I'm not going to be a pop star. And then all of a sudden it went off and I was a pop star all of a sudden. And going on Top of the Pops, which is brilliant.
Yeah, so tell me about the first appearance on Top of the Pops. That would have been with the Stuffies, wouldn't it?
Well, no, the first time I was on was when I did Born Free, and Blur were doing their first Top of the Pops as well. So I was knocking about with them. I think Johnny Marr was there as well, and I was talking to him about Fairport Convention. And yeah, it is quite a thing, you know, being on Top of the Pops. It is a very exciting, you know, I mean, because there isn't any Top of the Pops now. So it was a kind of iconic thing. If you've been on Top of the Pops, you've got there.
It's High Street famous, isn't it?
Yeah. And so quick as well. It's like, there's that. It was a bit like, you know, Jules's Hootenanny or something. It was like, there's a band. Here's another one. I remember seeing David Bowie there, and he was, when he was doing his, he was in a metal band for a bit, wasn't he?
Tin Machine.
Because he was David Bowie, he was kind of acting out the part like some mean and moody rocker. And he sort of walked past me scowling, and I went, oh, hello. And he went, yeah. Skulked past me. I always thought, and I still do think now, people must get excited when they're, you know, in a group of pop stars, you know. You go, oh, look at that. Look at that. You're like a kid in a sweet shop. And I shouldn't be here doing this. I can't be hanging about with David Bowie.
I was watching you doing Dizzy on Top of the Pops, and it's very apparent that everybody's having an absolute whale of a time.
Yeah.
It did seem
to be.
There
is a story behind that as well, and that's because this is when I did it with the Wonder Stuff. And I think when we got to number one, Miles Hunt from the Wonder Stuff said, you have a tequila shot, and he says, and about a minute in, you'll get another kick, and it'll just keep you going all the way through the song, full energy. So I thought, all right. And then Mariah Carey said, stop the performance, there's too much dry ice. So we had to go and do it again. So we did the same shot. Stop the performance, still too much dry ice. So we did it about six times, and we'd had six tequila shots by that time. So that's why we're all looking lively. And also the other day, in the rehearsals, there was a bank of washing machines behind, which was something to do with Whirlpool. I think there might have been some kind of, someone's got a bit of a backhander from the washing machine company here, because I mentioned Whirlpool in the song. So they put put a camera in one of the washing machines. So in rehearsals, I opened up the washing machine and do a line into the camera, which is in the washing machine. And then no one told me, but they took them out. So I most of my time on the actual night looking for the hidden camera in the washing machine, I've got the wrong one, but no one told me that they're taking it out. So if you ever see that, you can see me looking in the washing machines.
That makes sense. Was there like, oh, you've done one album, you should do another one, you should, come on, this is, you know.
Yeah, I would like to have done more. I did three singles off that, but I didn't really get paid much for doing that album. I mean, two number threes and a number one and a top-selling album. And I think, as far as I remember, I got about 30 grand. Then after that, I went to the tax man. So, you know, I don't think pop stars make as much money as people think. I did fancy doing another one, but I never got asked.
I mean, there's always time. There's always time.
Oh, yeah.
I can see behind you, for the purposes of people on radio, there's some craft work, artwork. Tell me about first hearing it.
When did that come out? It was early, wasn't it? About 73 or 4. Autobahn, I'm talking about. I thought, this is fantastic. It doesn't sound that modern now, but then it was so futuristic. So that kind of started me off on that electronic investigation. Yeah, and I've been a fan of Kraftwerk since then. But that was, I remember me and my friend when we must have been about 13 or 14 here in Autobahn, and we were going, this is the future. We've entered the future.
You ever seen them live?
I did, but it was one of those, you know, they did that tour and there was just robots. So it was just the mannequins on a stage, which I thought was quite funny because I think they were doing it from their Connie Plank's place in Dusseldorf, so it was just piped around the world at the same time. But I thought it was quite funny, a lot of people all watching some mannequins because they didn't do anything. I don't think they moved, they were just there on the stage. It was live because they were performing it live from their studio, but there wasn't much to look at.
Music was always really hugely important to Shooting Stars. It was always part of the kind of palette of the show. There's some stuff that's obviously held in huge affection.
Yeah.
That either you did or Matt Lucas did those songs. They've kind of almost, they have got a bit of a life of their own, those tracks now. They've kind of endured, haven't they? Which is kind of brilliant.
I think there's probably room for an album there for all the songs that we did, because we did a lot of songs, but that was just what we did. I mean, we were courted by the NME, the music press, when we started doing The Big Night Out and The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, because there wasn't anyone else doing comedy which sort of spoke to the NME audience, because we were doing music and we were making references to current music. So it just sort of felt that's just what we did. We really just did what we wanted to do and what we liked, and that was music. So there was a lot of good songs in there, yeah.
You did a track for a Noel Coward album, right? You remember this?
I did, yeah.
You did Don't Put Your Daughter on the Stage, Mrs. Worthington, and it was like a compilation album. And the other people on the album include The Divine Comedy, Paul McCartney, Pet Shop Boys, Brian Ferry, Marianne Faithfull, Sting, Damon Albarn, Elton John, Michael Nyman.
Yeah. Quite a lineup.
Quite a lineup. Can you remember doing that? Was Noel Coward kind of a passion of yours?
I was friends with Neil Tennant, and he said, "Hey, why don't you come and do one?" So I went, "Yeah, all right then." That was it. I went in and did it. More than that, I can't remember. I don't think I've heard it since it came out. I don't even know if I heard it then.
Regarding yours, dear Mrs. Worthington, of Wednesday the 23rd, although your baby maybe keen on a stage career, how can I make it clear that this is not a good idea? For her to hope, dear Mrs. Worthington, is on the face of it absurd. Her personality is not in reality inviting enough, exciting enough for this particular sphere. Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage.
Brian Eno.
Yeah, like a lot of people, I saw Roxy Music doing Virginia Plain on Top of the Pops and went, whoa, what is this? This is just the best thing ever. So I immediately became a big Roxy Music fan.
You're so chic, do you forever love me? Babies up the mountain, streamline. Midnight, you can see the floors. Dance the cha-cha fool to sunrise. Opens up exclusive doors for wow. Just like the windows look the same. So me and you, just me too, got to search for something new.
Eno just looked so great with his feathers and his silver gloves, and he really wasn't doing much at all apart from like twiddling a knob. And I thought, he looks cool. I want to be like him. And then when he left Roxy Music, his first three solo albums, I thought, this is me. This is right up my street. Because it had a bit of Henry Kerr, a bit of Robert Wyatt, all that group, that sort of gang of experimentalists that got together. And the songs were just, I think, pure pop. Baby's on Fire is still one of the best songs ever.
Baby's on fire, better throw her in the water. Look at her laughing like a heifer to the slaughter. Baby's on fire, and all the laughing boys are binging, waiting for photos. Oh, the plot is so bewitching. Distance to the object. Photographer, snip, snap. Take your time, she's only burning. This kind of experience, it's necessary for her learning. If you'll be my flotsam, I could be half the man I used to. They said you were hot star. Babies be reduced to.
Of all the kind of music-based characters and stuff that you've done, that you've written, do you have any favourites? Do you like, because obviously Home with Slade, you know, it was great, and Mulligan and O'Hare, I mean, you know, artists in their own right, I think.
Yeah, well, Mulligan and O'Hare were, they were always the fan favourites, but there was a very dark story behind those two that I don't think anyone ever knew, because they'd both murdered their wives and buried them under a caravan so they could be together. And Mulligan was taking hormone treatments so he could be a full woman and be O'Hare's wife.
I never knew that.
It wasn't really explained that well, but that is the truth. There you are. That's a revelation, too.
My love has left me. I'm in a mood. She went. Didn't stop us from trying. We were turned down for adoption because of her bizarre appearance. For us, how we loved you, but where are you now? Alone with your salesman, you adulterous cow.
When you're painting now, do you still listen to music?
Yeah, I do. And if I'm painting something that's a bit more violent, a bit more action going on, I'll find music which is according to what it is I'm doing. But I would say the most played would be No Pussyfooting, which is Brian Eno and Robert Fripp, Fripp and Eno. And it's ambient and it just drifts by in the background. So that is the most played.
And you can tally certain, like, if we're going to do birds, then I'm going to find something that's going to be more kind of fitting for that, or if I'm going to do like celebrity-based paintings, I'm going to go for something slightly different. Does it alter?
Oh, yeah, if I'm going to do something different, yeah, I'll put music on this. I play a lot of Fall in there as well.
Still,
yeah, I don't stray far from. Yeah, I do put new stuff on. I mean, I really like Jordy Greep. Do you know him?
Yeah,
he's in Black Midi. He's fantastic, and he's so clever because he's only about 25. Makes you feel old, doesn't it, when you go, oh, he's only 25. But I thought he's brilliant. You know, I mean, he sounds like he could have been around for centuries, but I think he's really good. He's one of the talented newcomers, I would say.
From the way you hide your makeup on, from the way you've done your hair, from the way you sat down next to me, from the way you ordered your drink, from the moment you put your hand on my knee, I knew I'd have you with ease. From the shores of Havana to Moscow and Tokyo, in French Guyanese, in Cantonese, everyone knows my name. All the revolutionaries, all the jihadis too, everyone knows I'm holy.
Are you getting passionate about musically at the moment then? What doesn't stray far from your record player? The Fall stays, Eno stays.
I'm always on the search and usually successful for strange classical stuff. And I just recently got into Messiaen, who was around in the sort of earlier, mid 20th century. I mean, I listen to Six music all the time, so I'm spoilt for choice.
Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead is always in the Messiaen camp. He's always waving that flag.
Well, that's a kind of new thing for me. So I recently discovered Messiaen. I used to go about with a leather motorcycle jacket on my motorbike, and I had Debussy in studs on the back of it. And it wasn't really ironic. It was just that I really liked Debussy. And I thought, you know, instead of putting the Rolling Stones or something like on the back of it, I'm going to put what I like on. Because I got into classical music, and odd way, because I thought, I know a bit, but I want to know more. So I used to get me pushback and go to the library in Lewisham and rent them out. I think they were 10 pence for a week. So get something out and then read the sleeve notes, and it would say so-and-so studied under someone else. So then I'd find them and do a sort of, I suppose it was like web surfing now, but reading the back of a Deutsche Grammophon record.
It seems to be that painting is your kind of your main thing now. Does the idea of making music hold any appeal? I mean, we talked about doing a follow-up album or...
Yes, it always does, but I don't know. If, I mean, I still play bass now and then.
Really?
Yeah. I've got a fretless that I mess about on and try and pretend to be Percy Jones or Jacob Astorius or someone, but it never, you know, my heart isn't as in it as much as it used to. But I've got really weird tinnitus because I'm deaf in one ear. I've got this sort of tinnitus which makes bleeping sound, like a lorry reversing and things like that. So I tried to play that on the piano the other day. I tried to play the notes that I'm hearing in my ear. And I thought, this would be quite good set to music to a big orchestra. So it'd be like Stockhausen or even Messiaen or something like that. So it'd be, yeah, I might make some some bizarre tinnitus-based concerto.
I reckon you could get in touch with Brian Eno. That would be right up his street.
Well, next time I see Brian, I'll mention it. I've only met him once before, so I don't know when that's going to be.
And final thing, what should we end on? What piece of music should we end the show on?
Well, we were talking about Captain Beefheart earlier on, so let's have Ella Guru from Trout Mask Replica. I think it's one of the more accessible tracks from that album. It's just got his fantastic voice on it, and the music's sublime.
Then that's the track we'll finish on. It's been good to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
Now here she come walking, looking like a zoo. Hi Ella Guru. She know all the colors that nature do. Hi Ella Guru. Red, high blue, she flew. High yellow guru. She do what she mean and she do what she do. Got something for me, got something for you. She show something.
Ella Guru by Captain Beefheart, the final choice of the guest on the first time today, Jim Moyer, better known perhaps as Vic Reeves. And Jim continues to create and exhibit his brilliant and beautiful and sometimes bizarre paintings, many of which focus on music, many more focus on birds, as captured in his two books, Birds, and the brilliant recently released More Birds. Thank you very much to Jim for being my guest here today on the first time. And that is the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time for this season, where my guest will be Ezra Furman. And of course, you can listen back to previous first-time shows from this season on BBC Sounds, which include my chats with Florence Welsh, Tom York, and one of the men of the moment, Liam Gallagher. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Right, right, just dig it.
That's right, the mascara stayed fast and bulbous. Tight also.